deadlines, Israel pushes ahead with its much-criticized demolition policy, destroying Palestinian commercial facilities near occupied Jerusalem, unquote. Campaigning for the upcoming presidential election is underway, and Iran will have a report about the promises and slogans of the candidate. And also, in our headlines, the African Union suspends Mali from the bloc and threatens it with sanctions after a second military coup in the country in 9 months. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour, Israeli forces have demolished more Palestinian structures in the occupied West Bank. Palestinian media say bulldozers accompanied by troops have flattened commercial facilities in the town of Izma, northeast of Jerusalem al-Quds. This is the latest in Israel's long-running campaign of demolishing Palestinian homes and properties. On Monday, Israeli forces razed to the ground several homes near Hebron, also known as Al-Khalil. Such violations are usually committed under the pretext that the structures have no construction permit. Israel is also pressing ahead with its settlement expansion policy in the West Bank. In defiance of international outcry, authorities have set in motion a project to build 350 settler units near Ramallah. The settlements are illegal under international law. Political expert Saad Nimr says Israel is pressing ahead with its expansionist policy to grab more Palestinian land before an international action halts it.
The settlers as well as the government took a kind of a step forward towards enlarging existing settlements and also to build new settlements and to demolish Palestinian houses and Palestinian facilities all over the West Bank. The settlers now are thinking that though the new administration in America came and they don't support them that much, but they want to grab as much time as they could before there will be a kind of an international stand against the settlers. So they are trying to fight the time and try to take the time that is necessary for them to build as much settlements as they are. Now we have these 350 units will going to be added to the settlement near Ramallah, Beit El, also enlarging lots of other settlements around and declaring building more settlements in Beit Lahem area and even in Jerusalem.
Israel has repeatedly claimed its recent airstrikes on the Gaza Strip targeted resistance groups and military sites, but reports on the ground contradict such a claim. Our correspondent in Gaza, Ruba Shabit, has conducted an interview with a survivor of the Israeli attacks who lost 30 members of her family. Here's more.
After the Israeli airstrike hit Al-Kolak family building in the Gaza Strip, Zainab Al-Kolak was rescued by the civil defense after spending 12 hours under the rubble of her home. Zainab survived, but at least 30 members of her family were killed by the Israeli raid in the latest escalation against Gaza. After repeated failures to extricate her from the rubble, rescue workers finally saved Zainab Al-Kolak, a 22-year-old Palestinian woman who lost her family members in an Israeli airstrike on their house in the Gaza Strip.
We all gathered in a room watching news, and I was using my phone. We heard two missiles hitting somewhere really close. We heard bombing before, but this one was different, and the home was shaking. We got really scared, and we even forgot to take our bags of important things that we prepared for any possible bombing. My mom and my only sister were next to me. The last thing I remember was everyone scared and didn't know what was happening. The roof fell on our heads. In less than a second, I found myself under the rubble.
Stuck under the rubble, Zainab used her cell phone and called the Gaza Ambulance Service, hoping they could help her and save her family. But it took hours until they saved her from the rubble because Israeli regime destroyed the main roads leading to her home and the hospital.
I was holding my phone while trapped under the rubble. The voices of my mom and sister just disappeared, and I started to call people. I don't know how I remembered the numbers of civil defense. I called them, but they couldn't reach me. I started to call my friends, Shaima and Fatima, but I wasn't able to tell them I was under the rubbles. I spent 12 hours there. I just imagined that when I called the civil defense, they would save us fast, but it took long to reach us, and eventually I lost the hope to stay alive.
Zainab, who studies English literature and is interested in arts, expressed that no words can describe her feeling of losing her family. While Zainab's father is still at hospital receiving treatment, Zainab is now worried about her new burdens and responsibilities after losing her mother.
This is not the first time Israel has done such a massacre. We lived our lives just between one war and another. We thought we were safe, but no one is. They hit us with no prior notice. We were a big family, and now I can count us on one hand. I used to be a normal student, and now I have millions of things to take care of as life throws me in the middle of everything.
Zainab and her family members are not the only victims of the Israeli attacks. 11 days of Israeli air, land, and sea assaults on Gaza killed 255 Palestinians, including 66 children. The strikes also wounded more than 1,900 people before a ceasefire went into effect on May the 21st. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Iran's envoy to the International Atomic Energy Agency says the agency's latest report confirms that Tehran is implementing the country's strategic parliamentary law. That law limits IAEA access and obliges Iran's Atomic Energy Organization to press ahead with enrichment and other nuclear activities that go over and beyond Iran's commitments under the nuclear deal, from Vienna Homolesky reports.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA's latest report on Iran is the first since the country stopped implementing voluntary transparency measures as a result of a law passed by Parliament restricting agency access to nuclear facilities. Under a temporary agreement between Tehran and the IAEA valid until the 24th of June, the agency will continue to collect data at Iran's key nuclear facilities via its surveillance equipment, but will not be able to access that data. Iran's envoy to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, said the agency had no access that had previously been provided under the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA.
The verification and monitoring activities that the agency had in our nuclear facilities based on the JCPOA, as the Director General reflected in his report, actually all those areas have been stopped and the agency didn't have any kind of access in accordance with the JCPOA to our nuclear sites and also the nuclear activities in the nuclear facilities.
In his report, IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi estimated Iran's stockpile of enriched uranium to be about 16 times higher than the limit set in the deal. Gharibabadi said Iran is continuing to enrich uranium at the level of 5, 20 and 60%. The limit set in the deal was 3.67%.
There is no suspension in the nuclear activities, such as installation of production, installation of new machines, and also the enrichment level and the stockpile. So it is very important that actually these kind of activities have not been affected even due to the nuclear negotiation that we have around the JCPOA in Vienna nowadays.
Iran stepped back from its nuclear commitments in response to the previous U.S. administration's withdrawal from the deal and the reimposition of sanctions.
Negotiations to revive the deal have been taking place in Vienna since April, with Tehran standing firm on its position. It will only return to full compliance after the U.S. has removed all sanctions in a verifiable manner. Homolizki, Vienna.
An Iranian logistic vessel sunk in the Gulf of Oman. The ship was on a training mission near international waters when one of its systems caught fire. Rescue teams managed to safely transfer the crew to the nearby port city of Jos. However, efforts to extinguish the fire were ineffective. The exact cause of the incident is under investigation. The vessel was used in training missions for more than four decades. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has called for public participation in the country's upcoming presidential vote. He said the election is the most important issue for the nation and urged people to cast their ballots with hope. Rouhani said people should choose the most qualified candidate as their next president, outlining capabilities in terms of planning and strategy. The president also stressed the importance of public support. He said his administration stood against several years of all-out economic warfare and foreign pressure only with support from the people. Rouhani also hailed the participation of the people in the country's election since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, calling it a determinant factor for the country to move forward. Now, Iran is holding its 13th presidential election on June 18th. Before that, the candidates are scheduled to appear in three live televised debates to outline their plans for the next 4 years. The Commission for Presidential Candidates Campaigns has set three dates for the live debates between the hopefuls on Iran's national television. The first debate is going to be aired on Saturday, June 5th, and the two others on Tuesday, June 8th, and Saturday, June 12th. The seven candidates will be given equal time to discuss their plans and answer the questions asked by the moderator in three-hour forums. Iran's presidential candidate, Saeed Jalili, has laid out his administration's plans in an interview. He says propping up foreign currency reserves would be a major priority for his government.
The governments should have plans and task each and every administrative sections with bringing foreign currencies into the country instead of being mere consumers.
Jalili vowed to develop the economy instead of just sustaining it. The former nuclear negotiator added that his team would seek to decrease Iran's dependency on oil by encouraging production and export in other sections. He noted that all branches of the government should be coordinated and managed by capable people. He also promised to balance liquidity with gross domestic production and stabilize the stock market. Moreover, Jalili touched upon the issue of corruption in his interview, saying that he would tackle it by creating a mechanism that prevents it from happening in the first place. Campaigning for the upcoming presidential election is underway in Iran due to the coronavirus pandemic. Campaigns are held in the form of televised addresses and debates. Yusuf Jalali reports.
With less than 3 weeks left to the 13th presidential election in Iran, the race gets tighter among the seven candidates, who are given equal airtime on Iran's national television to outline their plans. A change for the better is a promise each of the contenders are repeating to attract voters.
Our people need a peaceful life. Our youth need hope for a bright future. They need to live a vibrant life. Our people are suffering under economic pressure. They need to be freed from unemployment and poverty. The government must have an organized plan to address these issues.
The government needs to bring about reforms in areas that are prone to corruption. It must identify the cause of corruption and get rid of it. Corruption occurs where there is injustice. So if we base all our agenda upon justice, we will automatically uproot corruption.
Outgoing President Hassan Rouhani will hand over power with a host of unresolved issues. On top of them is the economy. That's why economic issues have become the focal point of campaigns, where each runner tries to offer the most convincing plan for fixing the economy.
Domestic production is a tailwind for our economy. If we pay attention to production and support our producers, we will solve major problems in our economy. The first step is to remove the hurdles that exist in the way of our producers.
Why should our people live with economic hardship while we have great capacities that have been ignored? Today, 40% of our production capacity is out of service. 70% of the economy is not tapped into. We could have used these opportunities to generate jobs and improve our people's livelihood.
This year, the coronavirus pandemic has curtailed election rallies and electoral tours. Based on the guidelines set by the Coronavirus Combat Committee, election campaigns will revolve around televised debates between candidates, feature documentaries, and speeches. Campaigning began on May 28th and will continue until 24 hours before Election Day, slated for June 18th.
All of the candidates are promising to bring about a change. Some are closer to reality, and others sound like sheer campaign slogans. But at the end, it all comes down to people's choice. When they cast their vote on June 18th. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran. We'll be right back.
Elsewhere, China has rejected a claim by Malaysia that Beijing breached the Southeast Asian nation's sovereignty by flying military aircraft over disputed waters in the South China Sea. A spokesman for the Chinese embassy in Kuala Lumpur says the activities routine flight training of the Chinese Air Force. He said the flights were in accordance with international law ruling out any violation of Malaysian airspace. The reaction came after Malaysia's foreign ministry said it would summon China's envoy for an explanation on what it called an intrusion. Malaysia's Air Force said on Monday it scrambled 16 Chinese jets with suspicious activity over the South China Sea. The waters have been a source of tension between Beijing and some other regional countries, including Malaysia. China claims more than 80% of the area. The African Union has suspended Mali with immediate effect and threatened the country with sanctions after a second military coup there in 9 months. The EU called for Mali's military to urgently and unconditionally return to the barracks and to refrain from further interference in the political processes of the country. The Union warned that if the military did not hand back power to civilian transitional leaders, it would impose targeted sanctions and other punitive measures. The putsch has sparked deep concerns over stability in the volatile Sahel region and warnings of economic penalties from across the international community. Far-right extremists continue to be inducted into the British military this week. Reports of several serving members of the UK armed forces referred to a controversial anti-extremism scheme has rekindled fears and reignited calls on the country's Ministry of Defense to increase its auditing and vetting processes. U.S. President Joe Biden has declared white supremacy the most lethal threat to his country on the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa race massacre. Biden made the remarks in an address to the three living survivors of the killing of more than 300 African Americans by white mobs in 1921. He stressed the importance of acknowledging the lives lost in that slaughter, noting that he's the first U.S. president ever to commemorate the event. Biden called for the U.S. to confront its long history of hatred and avoid silence about it. The U.S. president used the occasion to announce his administration's new measures against racial inequality and once again condemned the recent displays of white supremacy across the country. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Bye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In his speech on the anniversary of the passing of Imam Khomeini on the 3rd of June, 2020, Ayatollah Khamenei spoke about the transformations which Imam Khomeini brought about in Iran and the Iranian nation. By nature, Imam Khomeini was a person who advocated and brought about transformation. As for bringing about transformation, his role was not confined to being a mere teacher and instructor. Rather, he played the role of a commander active on the field and leading in the true sense of the word. First of all, he had the spirit of advocating transformation since long ago. This was not something that emerged in him at the beginning of the Islamic movement in the year 1962. Since his youth, he was an advocate of transformation. Evidence for this is the piece he wrote at the office of the late Waziri Yazdi in his youth. When he was in his 30s, later on, the late Waziri Yazdi showed me the same writing. I have seen it published and many people have access to it today. In that essay, he quotes this holy ayah. I admonish you on one point. That you do stand up before Allah in pairs or singly. The Holy Quran, chapter 34, verse 46. This ayah invites the masses of people to rise for the sake of God. He had such a mentality. After that, he put his idea into practice, and as I mentioned, he carried out a transformation. He entered the arena of transformation in action, not just in words and in commands.
Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah.
In my youth, during the time when the movement began to take shape, the Iranian nation was a nation that was not preoccupied with its fundamental issues. They had given up and they were passive. They did not have an opinion about their personal lives. There was no trace of dynamism, active presence and insistence on big and important issues in the behavior and conduct of our people. However, Imam arose these qualities in the people. He turned the same submissive and passive nation into a determined nation that pursued its demands. His inspiring, stirring, and stimulating speeches moved the people in a way that they turned into a people with demands. An example of this pursuance of demands is the events of the year 1341, according to the solar calendar, when the Islamic movement started, during which time the people held massive demonstrations in different cities, which ended in the events of 15th of Khordad. On the 15th of Khordad, despite a large-scale massacre, the regime could not extinguish the movement, and the people continued to stage uprisings until the end. That was an astonishing transformation that had been masterminded by Imam.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Thank you.
respond.
Israel's war on Gaza ended over a week ago, but voices in condemnation of the regime's crimes against the Palestinian people are still being heard around the world. Pro-Palestinian activists from across the United States descended on the capital, Washington, D.C., to hold a rally. The protesters called on Israel to stop killing Palestinians. They also called for an end to Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories and demanded that the U.S. government stop funding the regime.
For us, we need to demand the following. One, immediate, unconditional lifting of the siege on Gaza. Let me repeat, immediate, unconditional lifting of the siege on Gaza, because that is what international law requires. Second, we need to hold Israel accountable in the International Criminal Court. Netanyahu is a criminal war, committed war crime. We need to take Israel to the International Criminal Court. Third, we need the implementation of the four Geneva Conventions. Palestinians should be protected, not demonized.
It's definitely significant. There hasn't been a demonstration. They're not huge demonstrations. It's hundreds of people, but that's better than nothing at all. And it's not just in Washington, it's in New York, in Boston, in Michigan, Dearborn, there are, as you said, in London as well. So the visibility is there where it wasn't before on Palestinian issues. So this is really a change. And also there's now, it's quite acceptable for Congress and Senate to put forward bills to curb the so-called aid, the military gifts of $3 billion every year for Israel to destroy Palestinians.
Other speakers rejected attempts by corporate media to use the manufactured anti-Semitism crisis to undermine public support for the Palestinian cause. Israel's foreign minister, Gabi Ashkenazi, arrived in the Egyptian capital, Cairo, on Sunday to discuss the May 21st truce. It marked the first formal visit by an Israeli foreign minister to Egypt in 13 years. Ashkenazi had earlier said he'd discuss what he called a permanent ceasefire with Egypt's officials. The truce was brokered and is being monitored by Egypt.
Just calling for a permanent ceasefire, it makes you want to laugh, because a ceasefire is a break in hostilities. A permanent ceasefire would be peace. So if what they're calling for is peace, well, then now you're going to have to get into how do you come about peace. You have to negotiate. And who are you going to negotiate with? Well, you have to negotiate with Hamas, because the PA has really no authority here. So the very first thing, before anything, you have to have elections. So somehow Israel's got to allow elections to go ahead. But they won't want to do that, because that will elect Hamas. But in any case, they're going to have to deal with Hamas on a ceasefire, because Hamas is the military power, the only resistance, active resistance. The PA is basically just a caretaker for Israel.
Palestinians have hailed their victory in the battle, citing their show of force to the Israeli regime by launching over 4,000 rockets and scores of drones to combat the enemy. Secretary General of the Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad al-Nakhala, has said the fight with Israel proved that Palestinians can overcome all challenges with a strong will. Nakhala added that for every Palestinian killed by Israel, the resistance will bomb Tel Aviv. The developments over the past month have shown that the next time the regime ventures an offensive against Gaza, it would face grave consequences.
A mass grave containing the remains of 215 indigenous children has been discovered in Canada. The remains were unearthed at the site of a former residential school for indigenous children near the town of Kamloops in British Columbia. The bodies belonged to students, including some as young as 3 years old. The authorities said an investigation into the timing and cause of their death is underway. The Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, reacted to the news by calling it distressing and a reminder of a dark chapter in Canada's history. Also, Canada's National Centre for Truth and Reconciliation said in a statement that the discovery of bodies of Indigenous children at a former residential school is a reminder of the violence that had been inflicted on Indigenous societies. The Kamloops Indian Residential School was the largest in Canada's residential school system. It was part of a network of schools run by the Roman Catholic Church from the 1870s until 1996. For more than a century, Canadian authorities forcibly assimilated Indigenous children by separating them from their families and forbidding them from speaking their native languages or performing cultural practices. Residential schools' main objective was assimilating the children into white Canadian society by severing their Indigenous family and cultural ties. These were the values that colonial settlers, who made up the majority of the population at that time, brought to Canada. Children were victims of widespread physical, emotional, and sexual abuses within these institutions. Today, those experiences are blamed for a high incidence of poverty, alcoholism, and domestic violence, as well as high suicide rates in their community.
The land that is stolen from them is simply a result. It's not the cause. It is certainly part and parcel of it. The Indigenous population has suffered greatly since the first white Europeans colonists came to Canada. They stole the land, but they oppressed the people. They killed them. They enslaved them. This is a long, long history of settler colonialism that Canada has not yet come completely to terms with, and it needs to.
...150,000 Native or First Nations children were forcibly removed from their families and sent to residential schools. Schools were rife with physical abuse, rape, malnutrition, and other atrocities against the children. A 2015 investigation into Canada's residential school network concluded that the Canadian government and churches have pursued a policy of cultural genocide against the country's rightful owners. The documents revealed that many students lost their lives because they were exposed to outbreaks of measles, tuberculosis, influenza, and other contagious diseases. Over 4,100 children died due to diseases or in accidents at schools have been identified to date. They were often buried in unmarked graves without identification or notice to their parents. Moreover, while the residential schools may be closed, Indigenous children continue to be separated from their families in disproportionate numbers. According to census data, in 2016, more than 52% of children in foster care were Indigenous. That's while Indigenous children made up 7.7% of Canada's all foster children in care population. The systematic discrimination against Indigenous people in Canada has existed for decades. Despite making up just 5% of Canada's population, 30% of the country's prisoners are Indigenous. Also, the government has willfully and recklessly discriminated against Indigenous children living on reserves by failing to provide funding for child and family services.
Yes, their rights will be respected, but will be because of activists, people within the Native community who are working very hard now. There are many, many people who are working for the rights of Indigenous people, people not only members of that community, but members of other communities within Canada. They're working hard to implement government changes, to make the government see that it must respect their rights.
Forced removal, genocide, and assimilation are what colonial settlers inflicted on the Indigenous peoples in Canada. After all,
What's for sure is that Canada's foundation as a country is based upon the process of colonization.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are still reeling from the most recent Israeli onslaught against the coastal territory. Such scenes of destruction are seen throughout Gaza, with many families camping near their flattened homes. It could take many months before these ruined buildings are rebuilt. Israel's devastating onslaught left scores of Palestinians, including dozens of children, dead. The war was another stark reminder of how brutal the regime can be in dealing with the people it has subjugated for many decades. The Israelis argued during the operation that they were trying to wipe out resistance groups and their capabilities. But that's implausible because the sheer number of civilian casualties and horrific scenes of destruction of residential buildings leave no doubt that the regime committed numerous crimes and violations during its latest war. On Thursday, the United Nations Human Rights Council voted to launch an international investigation into the war. The draft resolution was presented by Pakistan on behalf of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and the Palestinian delegation to the United Nations. Pakistan's ambassador to the OIC, Khalil Hashmi, who was speaking on behalf of the organization, sharply criticized Israel's supporters. He blasted Israel's allies for shielding the occupier from global accountability and providing arms and ammunition for its widely reported war crimes and crimes of apartheid against the Palestinian people. United Nations Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet had tough words for Israel. She rejected Israeli claims that the destroyed buildings in Gaza were hosting members of the Palestinian resistance groups or used for military purposes. Meanwhile, the UN rights chief also criticized Hamas for firing rockets at Israeli cities, saying it constituted, quote, a clear violation of international humanitarian law. Thursday's announcement of an international investigation into alleged crimes committed during the 11-day war seems to have enraged the Israelis. The regime was quick to reject the decision, saying it would not cooperate with the probe. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, on the other hand, welcomed the investigation. The United States, which has observer status and no vote at the Geneva Forum, refrained from speaking at the special session. The investigators will have a broad mandate to look into all alleged violations. The probe will cover not just the Gaza Strip, but also the occupied West Bank and the Israeli cities, which came under retaliatory rocket attacks by Palestinian resistance groups. Future findings of the independent investigation are expected to once again mount pressure on the Israeli regime. But will its allies allow any meaningful action against it? The U.S. in particular has been extremely supportive of Tel Aviv. Observers believe this unwavering support leaves no room for the U.S. to want to be a mediator between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Obviously, for people in Palestine, for many, many countries in the world, the notion of the United States being a mediator is simply a derisory. It's a joke, and nobody believes it. But for internal domestic consumption, that's important. It also is a fig leaf for Europeans, particularly the British, but others, to say, well, the United States is in charge, and we don't have to do anything. But I think increasingly, and we see that, increasingly, the United States is no longer considered to be a mediator. The Palestinians, for sure, cannot continue to do this. Abbas cannot continue to agree to these things, and that's obvious.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are still reeling from the most recent Israeli onslaught against the coastal territory. Such scenes of destruction are seen throughout Gaza, with many families camping near their flattened homes. It could take many months before these ruined buildings are rebuilt. Israel's devastating onslaught left scores of Palestinians, including dozens of children, dead. The war was another stark reminder of how brutal the regime can be in dealing with the people it has subjugated for many decades. The Israelis argued during the operation that they were trying to wipe out resistance groups and their capabilities. But that's implausible because the sheer number of civilian casualties and horrific scenes of destruction of residential buildings leave no doubt that the regime committed numerous crimes and violations during its latest war. On Thursday, the United Nations Human Rights Council voted to launch an international investigation into the war. The draft resolution was presented by Pakistan on behalf of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and the Palestinian delegation to the United Nations. Pakistan's ambassador to the OIC, Khalil Hashmi, who was speaking on behalf of the organization, sharply criticized Israel's supporters. He blasted Israel's allies for shielding the occupier from global accountability and providing arms and ammunition for its widely reported war crimes and crimes of apartheid against the Palestinian people. United Nations Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet had tough words for Israel. She rejected Israeli claims that the destroyed buildings in Gaza were hosting members of the Palestinian resistance groups or used for military purposes. Meanwhile, the UN rights chief also criticized Hamas for firing rockets at Israeli cities, saying it constituted, quote, a clear violation of international humanitarian law. Thursday's announcement of an international investigation into alleged crimes committed during the 11-day war seems to have enraged the Israelis. The regime was quick to reject the decision, saying it would not cooperate with the probe. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, on the other hand, welcomed the investigation. The United States, which has observer status and no vote at the Geneva Forum, refrained from speaking at the special session. The investigators will have a broad mandate to look into all alleged violations. The probe will cover not just the Gaza Strip, but also the occupied West Bank and the Israeli cities, which came under retaliatory rocket attacks by Palestinian resistance groups. Future findings of the independent investigation are expected to once again mount pressure on the Israeli regime. But will its allies allow any meaningful action against it? The U.S. in particular has been extremely supportive of Tel Aviv. Observers believe this unwavering support leaves no room for the U.S. to want to be a mediator between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Obviously, for people in Palestine, for many, many countries in the world, the notion of the United States being a mediator is simply a derisory. It's a joke, and nobody believes it. But for internal domestic consumption, that's important. It also is a fig leaf for Europeans, particularly the British, but others, to say, well, the United States is in charge, and we don't have to do anything. But I think increasingly, and we see that, increasingly, the United States is no longer considered to be a mediator. The Palestinians, for sure, cannot continue to do this. Abbas cannot continue to agree to these things, and that's obvious.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Today, we're going to be talking about Islamic laws about usury according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Before dealing with these questions, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahth al-Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching, Makassar, some of the advanced classes in the Hauza he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Jawid, we are talking about Islamic laws about usury, according to Ayatollah Khomeini. Let me start this episode with this question. If you sell 1 kilo of rice for 2 kilos of wheat, rice for wheat,
yes,
is this transaction valid? Is it okay? Or you would define it as usury?
Well, rice is one thing and wheat is something else. These two commodities are different, essentially different, okay? As long as they are different, usury does not apply. The rules regarding usury will not apply.
But so you considered or equated the wheat with barley.
Barley, of course, according to Sharia and according to Fuqaha, the religious authorities, wheat and barley are of the same category. Mm. Therefore, you cannot.
They look very much alike.
They of course, they look very much alike.
But rice is white.
Rice is something. Rice is rice. You see, is white. You see, wheat is something else. They look like.
And usually humans eat it, but
yes,
wheat.
And you cannot compare between between wheat, barley, and rice. Wheat and barley are look very much alike, of course. And therefore, if you buy 2 kilos of wheat against 3 kilos of barley, it is haram, it is usury, and it's forbidden. But if you do the same with rice, it's not haram. And of course, according in the eye of custom and also in the eye of Sharia, these two things are different. But you know, here custom does not have a say. Okay, and when it comes to wheat and barley. We know that wheat and barley, according to custom, are two different things, you see. Mm-hmm. When you go to the rural areas and you go to the farms, you will see that farmers will not consider barley as wheat and wheat as barley. They are two different things. And of course, unfortunately, the farmers, generally speaking, do not have proper and precise knowledge of the Islamic laws about these things, okay? They generally end up falling into a mistake because of a lack of knowledge, a lack of understanding of the religious laws. They commit such mistakes, exchanging, for example, wheat against barley, and receiving something in addition to the weighed object, okay, to the thing sold against, yes, to the thing sold. So such mistakes do happen, and of course, people, because of a lack of knowledge, they make mistakes, and they are not to blame, okay? Because in rural areas especially, people do not have access to religious authorities. They do not have access to the manual of Islamic laws to read, and obviously they have less knowledge as compared to the people living in cities, because they have access to books, to the internet, to the cyberspace, and they can ask their questions very easily.
Yes, but that was actually for the previous time, I guess.
Yeah,
because now we have internet, we have lots of facilities and technology, and usually even in the rural areas, they are equipped with not only the internet and the social networks, but also lots of media channels are broadcast to them, you know.
Yeah, in modern time,
television, radio channels, there are lots of things, lots of tools and means of getting information. So I don't think they are not to blame.
Yeah, in modern time, you could be right. Things are, the means of communication are available everywhere. But, you know, the farmers are very much preoccupied, okay? They do not make time to read things. Yes.
But this is their job, and if they want to have a kind of barter transaction, they need to know everything about, like the religious laws about what they do, right?
Yeah, that's very, it's very important for a farmer to know that you cannot sell 2 kilos of superior quality of wheat against 3 kilos of inferior quality of the same commodity, you see.
Yes.
You see, it is forbidden, regardless of whether the commodity you sell is defective or faultless or in good shape or in bad shape. According to Islamic Sharia, riba is forbidden, and riba means increase, riba means addition. Islam is strictly against riba.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Since you talked about the good or bad quality of something,